pride and arrogance. There is not a man in all the courts of the world who will not hear of this and suspect your character and virtues to be stained, suspect. You have thrown yourself at a man of lesser standing and titles than yourself, and he has cast you off. Now, where before you looked like a beautiful, noble lady who could bring honor and glory to your husband, you now appear a slattern, with no knowledge or understanding of the world, an immoral jade, with no regard for her position or her family. You are disgraced, Matilda. The best that we can do is to hope that we can bury this incident in time. But before that happens, all of the family will have to share in your humiliation and ignominy. You have brought dishonor upon us. She turned to me, her face twisted. I am ashamed to call you my daughter. I barely listened to my mother's words. I cared not if she was upset. My heart was broken, but it was even now healing itself by stitching together its rent pieces with the mordant thread of hatred. Rage boiled in my veins. How dared the Saxon Snow reject me and see me so humiliated? How dared he? He should have been grateful for the honor of marrying one such as me. That is all we can do, agreed my father at last, running his hands through his hair, making it stick up as though he were a sweaty boar in the undergrowth. Wait for the shame of this to dissipate. Perhaps we can pass it off as some female malady? He turned to my mother with eyebrows raised, and I felt another leap of anger. We do not want her to be thought unstable, my mother said ponderously, as though I was not there. But perhaps it bears consideration. We might be able to say that she was suffering of a fever, my lord, and was delusional. Such fantasies pass when the fever cools. My father looked down at me, with abhorrence in his face. Get this unnatural thing from my sight, he commanded my mother. And know this, girl. He thrust a thick finger, which smelt of pig flesh, into my bruised face. From this moment on, you have no privileges. I was too lenient, too proud of you. And look where this has taken us. You will stay indoors. You will appear at court only when commanded. You will be in all your doings a modest and virtuous maiden, and you will have no control over any servant. I want a report of your actions each day, and if I hear even that you have breathed out of turn, then I will do more than mark that pretty face you are so proud of. I'll have you shipped to a convent for the rest of your life. I will make sure it is one where they make your knees bleed for praying, and they whip you as often as possible for any sinful thought. I'll have you placed on an island in a cold tower where none can reach you. You will end your days with all your good looks wasted away in the darkness, and all your fine learning forgotten in the torment of your body. He called to my servants, who picked me from the floor and almost carried me back to my rooms. I was bruised and woozy, feeling nauseous from his beating, but still I did not fear my father or his threats. I knew they were false. I was too valuable a commodity to be sent to some convent to rot for the rest of my life. My head was whirling from the impact of his hard hands. My pride and my vanity were wounded by this so public rejection by Brithric. But, above all other feelings of pain and horror, was one overwhelming feeling and resolve which raged within me. Fury. I wanted that Saxon's head. How dared he refuse my offer of marriage? I was the best match and the greatest beauty he was ever likely to meet. and he had turned me down because he was worried for the world's opinion of my proposal? Weakling, spineless, feeble, craven worm! That he should fear what others may think of him so much as to refuse the greatest prize that would ever come his way. Fool. Cowardly, timid, spiritless dog. Two things I was assured of as I winced under the gentle hands of those who cleansed my eye and washed the encrusted blood from my face with sharp vinegar and wine. Firstly, that the Saxon, Brithric, was not the man I had thought he was, and I wanted to marry no gutless, weak-willed maggot in man's form. And, secondly, that however long I had to wait, I would find way and time to revenge myself on the pathetic, pusillanimous lord of the West. Blinking at my own red blood on my fingers, I swore that one day I would take vengeance on him for the shame he had brought to my name. One day, that thane would weep blood, as I did now. Chapter 5. Bruges Castle, Flanders, 1049. When I was nearing the age of 18, my father was engaged in a war as an ally to Godfrey the Bearded, Duke of Lorraine, against the Holy Roman Emperor, Henry the Third. It was a long conflict and one which, I believe, pushed my father to fully open negotiations for me to marry. He needed allies, and allies are more easily bought when there is a comely wife thrown into the bargain. My brother Baldwin was to marry that year with the Lady Richild, the young widow of Herman, Count of Mons. The Count of Mons, who had recently and most obligingly died, had been an ally of Henry the Third, and as such, our enemy. We had lost territory to the Count when he lived, but when Herman died, my father arranged for my brother to marry his widow, and disinherited all children from her first marriage, uniting Hainaut with Flanders. Our father wished to do something similar with me, to use me to purchase another supporter for Flanders. Emissaries of his choice came to our castle, but I was less than pleased with the many my father wished me to wed. 2 years had passed since my disgrace with Brithric Mau, and, although I had obeyed all the restrictions my father placed on me, it had not mellowed my spirit, nor tamed my mind. I wanted to make my own choice in the man I should marry. My father despaired of me often, for the older I grew, the more I revealed my strong-willed nature to him. Beatings did not subdue me, and hard words did not touch me. I believed he worried on what I would become. But he was also proud of me, for as I grew into the full season of my womanhood, I became truly the most beautiful lady of Christendom. Reports of my loveliness carried far and wide. Tales were told of my striking looks by travelling poets and singers. When I entered a room, all eyes turned to me, staring with either admiration or with jealousy. I enjoyed both. Like honey and fresh cream, they mingled happily together in my mouth. I became the subject of ballads that made ladies of other courts squeak their teeth against each other with envy, and the men of other lands think on travelling to Bruges just to look on my face and imagine themselves rotting within my body. In time, the scandal caused my proposal to the Saxon snow dissipated. It became old news, long forgotten. Many wondered if it had ever been true in the first place, for when I was gazed upon, it seemed incongruous that such a virtuous maid as I might have attempted something so bold and audacious. But if all others had forgotten my humiliation, I had not. Deep within the slipping shadows of my heart, I hid the sting of the stain on my reputation that fool had caused. And at night, I would amuse myself by imagining what harms I would call down on him, when I had the power to do so. My anger was resentful, unrelenting, and unforgiving. At that time, our country was not only at war, but under threat from other foreign powers. The King of England, Edward, despite overtures of alliance in years past, was no friend to my father, and disliked his habit of offering shelter to political exiles from England. The Holy Roman Emperor, Henry III, stalked our borders on one side, and Edward offered help to our enemy from the other. The time was ripe for my father to sell off his daughter for an alliance that would strengthen his country. He looked to Normandy, and to the young bastard duke that ruled that unsteady, yet potentially powerful, country, for an alliance and for a son-in-law. I was not consulted on the matter, not until the emissaries from Normandy arrived, but when I was informed, I did not like it. "You would marry off your only daughter to a bastard, born of a tumble in a pigsty between Duke Robert the Devil and a common peasant whore?" I questioned my father bluntly when he announced his plans to me. He looked at me, his nostrils flaring with both anger and shock at my words, but he was also tired of fighting me. It happened more and more as I grew older. I had taken many beatings for my spirit, but I refused to let it die beneath the force of a man's hands. My father could hit me all he wanted. It would not quash the fire of my soul. Gradually, I was wearing him down. "It is not about one battle," I told myself each time I was pushed over a chair and a whip was taken to my flesh. "It is about winning the war." The stinging lashes of the whip would thrash against my naked thighs and buttocks, leaving heavy, throbbing wheels on my skin, but I let out no sound. I pushed my teeth together until I thought they would shatter with the strain of it, but I let out no sound. I would not whimper and cry at his beatings. I did not want my father to think that he had mastered me. In time, he seemed to lose his passion for chastising me. It had no impact. Now, he stared at me with anger, but I could see he was not about to strike me, especially not as he was about to show my beauty off to the visiting dignitaries. He wanted nothing to impair my worth.
"You cannot talk thus of the Duke, daughter," sighed my father. "He is a noble lord and a ruler. He has been proven in battle many times and is a powerful magnet."
"He's a bastard and the son of a whore," I replied, my voice sharp with acidic condemnation. "I will marry no such man. It would be a disgrace to the name I carry and to the line I will bear. Find another husband for me, my lord father, for if you want me to marry this one, you will have to shackle me to the altar to bring it to pass. I swear to you, I will not go quiet to a union which so dishonors me." My father let his breath out from his nostrils, attempting to find the energy to fight me. He was growing old, and was weary of my spirit.
"You must at least receive the Duke's emissaries with grace, daughter," he protested. "I need no more enemies to take up arms against us. Our country is under threat. Other lords look on my lands with covetous eyes. We need allies to survive."
"If we have enemies, father, then it shows we are strong. It shows that we have much others desire."
"You think it good to be surrounded by those who would seek to take all from us?" he asked incredulously. "Child, you are too young and too entrenched in those myths and stories of old. Enemies do not show the strength of a country. Alliances do."
I nodded, but I did not agree. The emissaries from Normandy arrived, They wore dark clothes and looked as though they expected attack at any moment. As well they might, for Normandy was a country that was always under assault, as much from within as without. They had a bad habit of losing their dukes, these Normans. One such was Richard III, who ruled for but 1 year before dying in peculiar circumstances and being succeeded by his brother Robert, the devil. When Robert was a young man, he had been a man of fierce passion and impatient temper. They said that half the peasant girls in Normandy had a child by him, and that he had slain his own brother. One day, he had come across a tanner's daughter washing hides in a village pond, and was so taken with her beauty, they said, that he had her kidnapped and brought to his castle to be his mistress. Erleva was the name of the woman, and although some said he treated her like a wife, they never married. Erleva was Robert's mistress. The result of their union was his son, William. Robert died young on his return from a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and left his country to the only son he had acknowledged as his own, his little bastard, William. Even though the boy was illegitimate, some nobles rallied to keep the line of the Dukes of Normandy as their rulers. Erleva married a lord of lesser standing than her lover, the Duke, and gave the little bastard of Normandy 2 stepbrothers, Odo and Robert, who in time became their brother's protectors. There were also 2 daughters born to the couple, Emma and Muriel. William was recognized as Duke of Normandy by the King of Francia, Henry I, but there were many others who did not wish to uphold the claim of the child duke. Descendants of Richard II, who thought they had better claim to the title, made ever more wild and varied attempts to either kill the child or possess him. William grew up being smuggled from one place to another, with those who were loyal to him, and his father seeking to protect the child against an onslaught of both open rebellion and devious murder. William's cousins, Alan, Count of Brittany, and Gilbert, Count of Bouillon, were his first protectors. But Alan fell in a siege, and Gilbert followed shortly after, murdered by his enemies on a hunting trip. In 1041, William's tutor, Tyrold, was slain, and after that, his steward, Osburn, had his throat cut whilst he slept at the side of the Duke in the castle of Le Vaudreuil. The Duke himself was only saved by the swift action of his mother's brother, Walter, who saved his life. The little Duke grew up more often hiding low in the dirty cottages of his peasants than in the great castles of his kingdom. Some of his rivals wanted to kill him, some wanted to possess and control him, but all were after him. It was only due to the sacrifice and service of loyal knights, such as William Fitz Osborne and Roger of Montgomery, that William grew into adulthood at all. As William grew into a young man, he was invested as a knight, and from that day on, the sword became as much a part of him as any limb or organ of his body. In 1047, as I was being rejected by the weakling Brithric, William came to the head of an army to fight one of his deadliest enemies, Count Guy of Burgundy. The Count coveted William's title. He was a grandson of Richard II and, he claimed, had a better right to the title than a bastard upstart born to a concubine of Robert the Devil. Guy had no interest in controlling the young duke. He wanted to kill him. At Velay-Dune, the 2 armies met. William's army was outnumbered, but the King of Francia, my own uncle Henri I, supported William's claim and sent forces to aid him. Without his help, William would have been defeated and deposed, but with 10,000 additional men, under the command of his fiercely loyal generals, Fitz Osborne and Montgomery, the bloody battle was won by William. He was but 19 years old. The young man had proved he was a military leader, and in the stories of the battle which followed, all spoke of his brutal swordsmanship and ferocious fighting skills. You would have thought this would be enough to impress a woman such as I was, one who coveted power and strength. But when I thought on this duke, I saw only the reports of his bastard low birth. I saw a land in turmoil that was as yet not under his full control. I saw a man who had to be helped by another king to win a battle. I saw a man who had spent most of his life being protected and shielded by others. Even talk of his skill in battle did not impress me. Men are ever fond of exaggerating prowess in war, after all. I looked on the state of Normandy with disdain. Compared to my father's kingdom in Flanders, surely this one was weaker. Their lands were often invaded. Many laid claim to his title. The duke himself was so young that I thought he could not have much influence, and Normandy was often in turbulence as he fought to retain control. And he was the son of a peasant woman, a tanner's daughter, no matter who his father was. I also heard rumors that he was not a full man, and he was impotent. He did not, it was said, take mistresses or other women to his bed, and so rumors grew about him that he was incapable of the act, or perhaps preferred the company of men to women. Such ideas did not win my heart. All I could see in my father's choice was a future with a man not strong enough to hold his own country together, a man with polluted heritage, a man who would bring common blood of a common whore to mingle with my own. If he was even capable of making a child in my womb, that was. When the emissaries arrived and were presented to me, I had already made up my mind. My father had sent descriptions of my beauty to William, and the Duke was apparently most keen, not only on the advantages of an alliance with my father, but on my own personal charms as well. But I was not willing to be sold to a man so far beneath me. If I could not make my own choice, I would not be forced into my father's choice either. I would find a way to stop this marriage. I would not be sold off to this bastard whoreson. As the court settled, and the emissaries went to open their mouths and start to talk to me of the charms of their master, I opened my mouth, and loudly, so loudly that all could hear me, said, "I know not why you have come, my lords, for no true daughter of Flanders or the royal house of the Franks would ever think to marry a base bastard born from a common whore." I looked around me at the faces frozen in horror, and felt like laughing. "I will marry no bastard born so far below me. That is my answer to this suit," I announced in a voice that rang about the smoky great hall like the pealing of great church bells. My father stared at me in horror. The emissaries flushed and muttered angrily amongst themselves. My mother went pale. I was hurried from the great hall as the court exploded into talk and mirth. All were laughing at my daring, and at the terrible insult done to the House of Normandy. I received a rigorous beating that night for my public defiance of my father's wishes. I cared not. I smirked as he lashed me with his whip. I had won. The bastard Duke of Normandy would not marry a woman who had so publicly insulted him. I had escaped this marriage. 10 days later, William came, riding like a fury of old, to find me and take his revenge. Chapter 6. Bruges Castle, Flanders, 1049. Present day. William, Duke of Normandy, stood before me, his eyes wary. He feared that he was being led into a trap, and that I was the honey-coated treat being waved before him to entice him in. He had beaten me in the streets. He had dishonored the name of my father. And yet, here he was, brought to our castle by my acceptance of his suit. No wonder he did not trust what he was being offered. It was too surreal for anyone to understand, aside from me. I understood my own ambition. I wanted to be joined to a man of power, a man of strength, a man whom others feared. I had never seen this man's match. He was the Lord for me, the one who would bring me all I desired. I was aware of the risks I ran in marrying a man with such fire in him, but I reasoned that any husband I was given would have the right to beat me. I was beaten often enough by my father now. I might as well choose the man I thought most likely to bring me influence and power, as one who would not. I was unafraid as I watched him. I was but 18 when I stood there, but I knew what I wanted of life already. "My lord," I said warmly, dropping to a curtsy before him. He raised me up to look at him. His eyes, dark and blue like the sea, gazed at me with wonder and with caution. Still, he feared a trap. He bowed to me. "This is a more clement introduction than our last meeting, my lord," I teased, as I saw him wince at my words. "I behaved wickedly." His cheekbones flushed with a touch of pink. "My advisers believed that your father would murder me and wage war on Normandy. My mother refused to see me for days after my horrific act. But yet, it would seem you have forgiven me, my lady." I smiled and lifted my face to him. I saw his eyes kindle with flames of hunger for me. In his blue eyes, I could see my own sparkling back at me. A slight shiver of excitement passed through me, and my lips parted as I drew in breath to steel the force of my sudden rush of desire for this man. He was unlike any man or lord I had ever met. He was more powerful, more able to instill fear into those about him than anyone I had ever known. In a world where lands and countries are conquered and held by force and fear, this man could be the most powerful of all men. I felt it then, as I had felt it when he assaulted me in the street. No man had moved to stop him when he beat me to the ground. None had dared. And not because they did not love me as the daughter of their ruler, but because they feared him above all other men. Love and fear, they are the two emotions that give one power in this world. I had the capacity to make all around me love me, and he could make all fear him. Together, we could be more powerful than any could imagine. "You are not like ordinary women, Lady Matilda." His voice was deep and gruff. I liked it. "And therefore, my lord," I said softly, "I could never settle for an ordinary man." I could see the slackening expression of a man who desired the woman standing before him. His eyes searched mine for an answer. Why had I now asked to marry him, above all others? This man who had beat me and disgraced me. This man who had dared to ride into the dominion of my own father, ignoring every law, every soldier or army that might have caused others to stop, just to avenge a slur upon his name. I reached out and touched his arm. I lifted my lips to his ear and whispered into it so that only he could hear me. "Think you that such a soul as I would want to live my days married to some craven lord or duke? Shut up in a tower or castle, where my life will pass into obscurity and fade like the passing of the seasons? There is nothing in me that desires a life of quietness. I want only the most powerful man to pledge my troth to, a warrior who will take what he wants, who fears nothing and no man, and will lead me into glory with him. I want the most powerful of all men to be joined to. I think I see such a man in you. But if you are not he, my lord, then say so now, and leave. I heard him breathe in. The closeness of my body was making him nervous. I am he. William stared at me with firm, fierce eyes. He liked all that I had said, and I knew he understood me. I wanted a powerful man to be joined to, one who could master any land or lord, or people that he desired. I leaned back on my heels and regarded him with steady eyes. "Prove it, my lord," I challenged, a soft smile lifting my lips. His most serious, handsome face broke into a smile. It looked as though he had had small practice in smiling in his life, for his was crooked, but I found it most appealing.
"I will spend the rest of our lives together, my lady," he said, "doing just that."
I watched with satisfaction when the glazed look of desire spread over his eyes. "Come then, my lord," I said. "My lord father is most anxious to meet with you." The rueful look of disbelief on his face caused me to hiccup with laughter briefly, before I managed to curtail it. William looked at me, and his face broke into a grin.
"I can't imagine," he whispered, "that your father is indeed so keen to meet me. After our first meeting, he declared war between our countries for your sake, my lady."
"Of course, my lord," I shrugged. "Would you not do the same for one of our daughters, if she was so insulted?" He looked at me with sharp chagrin, but also with pleasure that I had mentioned the future of our marriage and children.
"I would have done more than declare war," he declared. "Should any man have touched a daughter of mine, I should have ripped his head from his body and fed his heart to the crows."
A small sigh of contentment came from me. He was indeed the man I had thought he was. "Well, let us hope that it is not my father's plan, then, my lord," I said impishly, a sentence I regretted immediately when I saw the wariness return to his eyes. "My father wishes you no harm, my lord," I assured him, and then almost laughed again when I saw that expression of distrust flash across his face. "Well, perhaps he would have liked to, but I have told him that you are the only man I will consider marrying. And if he wants to use his daughter for an alliance rather than sending me to a nunnery, then this is his only option." William reached for my hand and kissed it. Feeling him so close to me was starting to impair my senses. Although once I had looked on that Saxon worm Snow with desire, I realized in that moment that I had never wanted him as I did this man. William exuded an air of both menace and confidence. His blue eyes sparkled with intelligence, and he had the spirit of a man who has had to fight for all he has in life. His gold-red hair was like fire in the sunlight, and his face was handsome and hard. I had not realized that we were standing there staring at each other for such a long time, until one of my ladies coughed behind me to remind me that it was, perhaps, not seemly to stand so immersed in each other as everyone else simply looked on. Her cough brought me from my reflections on his face and character back to the present day. I led my future husband into the castle. It was likely to be an interesting night. After all, I had to present the man who had beaten me to the ground to my parents as their future son-in-law.
Chapter 7. Bruges Castle, Flanders, 1049. That night, my father put on a great feast and entertainment for the visiting Duke of Normandy. My father's own bands of tumblers, mummers, and jugglers performed alongside fools who gambled and insulted the nobles gathered, earning great gales of laughter for their efforts. Dancers dressed in costumes of allegory pranced about the great hall, telling stories with their own bodies. A feast was prepared,
and all at the court were waiting with bated breath to see this duke who had so insulted the noble bloodline of Flanders, and yet was now to become my husband. Unable to reconcile their feelings of disgust and rage at the duke for his beating of me in the street, and even less able to understand why this had prompted me to accept William's hand in marriage, my parents had apparently decided the best course of action was to ignore the event totally and act as though the marriage proposal had, in fact, been accepted when offered the first time. When all else fails to make sense, repressing the past can be a useful way to smooth the present. What is true is true. I watched William's arrival at the feast with great liking, seated, dressed in my most beautiful crimson gown at the head table. I had a good vantage point to watch the fluid movements of my future husband as he walked into the great hall. Smoke from the central fire plumed into the air, gathering like the collected ghosts of lost souls in the rafters. With his nobles and magnates, squires and pages behind him, William entered, still looking around cautiously, as though he thought a trap might await him. The chatter of the crowds grew still. He was dressed in a long tunic of fine blue linen, a cloak of scarlet fastened at his shoulder with a golden brooch, and with his sword at his side. William cut a tall, muscular, and impressive figure as he bowed to my father. I learned later that one hand was always on his sword, even when he was in genteel company. This was a man who was always ready for combat. I remembered the tales I had heard of his childhood, and began to understand that this was how and why he had survived. A true warrior bred from the roar of battle and danger. My father indicated William's place was between my father and me, and he watched the Duke of Normandy carefully as he sat down in the chair next to me. The hall erupted into talk once more, but all eyes were on us as the nobles took their places at the long tables for the feast. I looked up at my father and smiled warmly. He shook his head slightly, an indication not of disapproval, exactly, but of the lack of understanding he had of me and my character. But however much he did not understand me, in many ways my acceptance of the Duke had aided my father greatly. The match between William and me was of strategic importance to him and Flanders, and I had insisted on the match. So even though he did not understand why I should want this man so much, he had acquiesced. Fine courses of many foods were served before us. Fine white bread cut into trenchers sat before all the diners, carved by noble youths, sent to serve and train in the court of my father. Before us were pottages of boiled capon and bobbing green leeks, little tarts of pork stuffed with hot ginger, mussels and saffron sauce, and stews of small birds hunted in the fields and marshes of Flanders. Roasted venison, shining with verjuice of grapes, was presented on soft beds of cinnamon-spiced frumenty with saffron-yellowed eggs. Then came jellied eels with pepper and wild-grown cress, chicken and almond milk, golden cheese and succulent hog-flesh pies, Norman rabbit in sweet-sour syrup and wine, mutton stew with saffron, grilled quail glistening with melted butter, goose and sage and hyssop, and fried spinach fritters, fermented pickles of root, vegetables and onions, boiled garlic swimming in butter, and pepper sauces hummed their rich scents into the air. Between each course of food, a subtlety was brought in. At one time this was a pastry made into the form of a knight on his horse. The next was sugar crafted into a great dragon. Each entered the hall to grand acclaim, and they were made to show my father's wealth and greatness to the company. In the center of the room, the mummers put on a show as the diners talked and drank deep of the herbed ale, sweet mead, and fine wines of my father's house. Fig and raisin cream with cinnamon was set wobbling on the table beside bright cherry pottage, cream custard tarts, and fried fig pastries. Rose and almond cream with ginger was served in many delicate glazed bowls, along with applesauce, poached pears, and almond milk sweetened with honey. Minstrels played, and the great hall was filled with a bright buzz of conversation. My family and William sat on the high table, at the end of the great hall, with all the nobles of the court sitting on many more tables below us about the central fire. The nobles watched us with interest, gossiping about the rough wooing that had seen this occasion come to pass. But in my mind and my eyes, there was but one man there. William and I fell into staring at each other often. When the conversation lulled between us, we simply looked at each other with both desire and satisfaction. As we sat close together, I let one hand steal under the linen tablecloth and gently rest on William's thigh. My father and mother, and the court, could not see what I was doing, for the fine cloth spread over the table hid my actions. William's body stiffened as he felt the touch and feared attack, as was his way. But soon he realized it was just me, and he turned and smiled at me. I let my hand squeeze his leg gently, and felt him stiffen for another reason. I returned his smile sweetly, innocently, and his cheeks colored pink. He released a taut breath, but continued to eat and converse as though nothing was happening under the table, as I kept my hand on his leg. It was pleasurable to tease him thus. The small signs I had of both the enjoyment of my touch and the tenseness it caused in him made me want to giggle. But we covered ourselves well enough so that no others knew what I was doing. My father and mother kept up an awkward attempt at conversation with William, which he returned in kind. I think it was only I who did not feel discomforted by the memory of his beatings on me.
"With regard to your marriage with my daughter," my father said finally, and William and I turned our heads to him in unison, "there is a degree of kinship between you."
My father tore a chunk of fine white bread from the dish before him and dipped it in his trout pottage thoughtfully.
"Being both descended on one side of your lineage from the Dukes of Normandy, your marriage to my daughter will require a papal dispensation, if it is to be seen to be legal in the eyes of the church, my lord."
William nodded.
"I understand, my lord. My magnates have informed me that the matter will go to the Ecclesiastic Council in Reims, where Pope Leo IX will undertake many such matters."
He paused, taking up his carved leather goblet of wine. Those on the lower table shared great, communal goblets, but for the highest table where we sat, each lord and lady had their own.
"My council do not think this will be a matter that will be hard to succeed in,"
William continued, inclining his head as a servant came forth to fill his goblet from a jug of rich red wine.
"Nor do mine, my lord,"
my father agreed, inclining his head to the same servant to fill his cup with more wine too.
"With any luck, we will have this marriage resolved quickly."
I could almost hear my father's thought, "And before my daughter changes her mind again," echo from within his hairy ears. "I, too, wish for the marriage to go ahead as quickly as possible, my lords." I moved my hand on William's knee to trace my fingertip along his inner thigh under the table covering. "Now that I have found the man I was destined to marry, I want no delay in my path." William took up my hand, the one still in plain sight, and kissed it with reverence. His blue eyes were bright with desire and excitement.
There will be no delay, he agreed passionately. These matters will be resolved with all speed.
His face softened slightly as he looked at me.
I long to show you your new home, my lady, he said. Normandy will love you, as I do.
I am anxious to see my new country, my lord, I said. When we are joined, perhaps we could take a tour of your estates and lands, so that I might view Normandy, and your people may see their new duchess.
A wonderful idea, my lady, he said,
gazing at me with approval.
The people have not had a duchess since long before my father's time in power. They will be overjoyed to have a beautiful lady to rule over them.
Tell me of your mother, I asked suddenly. She was perhaps the reason your father did not marry in the church. His face clouded over. I was, after all, bringing up a subject that included the stain of his illegitimate birth. But there was softness in his expression, too. From that, I could glean that he loved his mother. He just did not want me, or any other, to insult her.
She met my father one day, when she was washing hides in the river, he said. For she was, as I am sure you know, my lady, a tanner's daughter, a girl of humble peasant stock.
He paused and looked at me, but I cared nothing for the accident of his blood now, not now that I had met him. I smiled to encourage him to continue.
She was, they say, the most beautiful girl in Normandy, he continued, stroking a finger around the wet rim of his goblet. Her hair was long and golden, with a flash of red in it like the sunset. But she was more than merely pretty, for she was also strong-willed and clever. When my father, Duke Robert, came riding past, he was entranced by her beauty, but he thought of her as nothing more than a diversion. He pulled a wry face. Until he met my mother, my father had many such diversions.
And has that trait continued into his son? I questioned. William shook his head, his face serious.
No, he said simply. My youth has been mostly taken with war, or with surviving attacks from those determined to take my title, or my life. I swore to myself that when I found the woman I would marry, that my life and my body would be for her alone.
Good, I said with approval. That pleases me, my lord.
There were women on campaign from time to time, my lady, he whispered,
glancing sideways at me and looking a touch nervous in case such an admission would displease me.
Such is the nature of war, that women follow armies and give comfort to the men. But I have never taken a mistress or wife.
Let us keep it that way, my lord. I stroked his leg again, digging my nail slightly into his leg and making him wince. You will require no mistress nor camp followers now, my lord. I believe I can ensure you are content in your marriage bed. William looked as though he might start laughing, for my teasing grip on his leg under the table, but he managed to contain himself.
I believe you can, my lady.
And as he drank from his cup of wine, there was a smile playing on William's lips. He clearly did not know what to make of all this, but it seemed he was enjoying himself. Continue with your story, my lord. I removed my hand from his thigh and speared a slice of roasted venison from the shared platter before us with my knife. I mixed it gently in a sauce of spicy peppercorn and red wine and put it on my trencher. I picked up the meat with my fingers and put it into my mouth, chewing delicately. When I had swallowed, I wiped my mouth with a linen cloth over my shoulder and took up my cup of wine.
Your mother was washing hides at the river when the Duke came and fell in love with her?
William's lips formed an amused twist.
It was not love that first drew my father to my mother, milady, he said, lifting his eyebrows at me, but desire. My father was a young, lusty man, and when he saw my mother, he wanted her. He sent forth word that she should be brought to the castle that night, and taken to his chamber.
And so she went to him, I asked, popping more of the rich venison into my mouth. I liked the taste of the fiery pepper upon it. It made my tongue tingle with pleasure.
William grinned mischievously, his blue eyes dancing with merriment.
No, my lady, she did not. She sent the messengers back to the castle without her, and gave my father a message, that she would come to the castle as her lord had commanded, but she was not without maiden pride. If he wanted her to come, then he must send a horse for her to ride. She would come in daylight when his court was assembled, and she would have a room within his castle to call hers. In that way alone, she said, would she come to him, with pride and in honour.
My mouth must have fallen open in amazement, as William chuckled at my expression. I was in a state of wonderment. For a common peasant to command a duke? It was unheard of. It was a miracle, then, that she and her family were not punished for such audacity. I breathed with admiration. There are few lords who would stand for such a bargain with a peasant. Most men would have had her whipped and her father's hands cut off, or have her brought to their beds by force.
William tilted his head to one side, his expression amused.
There are some lords who find a bold spirit in a woman most attractive, milady, he said, clasping his hand over mine. Perhaps it is something unique to the lords of Normandy.
I laughed. Perhaps. I held up a piece of the venison for him to try. He took it from my fingers with his mouth, and as he did, he secretly allowed his tongue to gently flick over my finger. The sensation felt like wildfire passing through my blood. I swallowed. I was blushing and trying to rein in the feeling of desire and want for the man beside me. William was looking most pleased to have returned the favour for my teasing stroking of his leg. There was an expression of both naughtiness and craving on his face. I yearned to be alone with him.
"What then happened?" I asked, dragging my eyes from his. "Was she punished?"
"No, indeed, my lady," he smirked. "My father agreed to her requests. So interested he was in a woman where such beauty was combined with a spirit of courage and confidence. He sent a horse for her in the daylight, as she commanded, and the set of rooms he prepared for her were granted to her for life. My father sent money to her father, so that he could employ a servant to take her place in his trade. She went to live with my father that day, and remained with him until the end of his life, about a year after they were first joined. I was born."
"Did they never think to marry?"
William shook his head.
"Eleva, my mother, was too far below my father in station to become a duchess. He asked her to marry him once, but she refused, saying it would not help his status or name by marrying her. She is a woman of not only great beauty and intelligence, but pragmatism, too." He paused. "She was not happy at all that I came to Flanders on the past two occasions."
"Why?"
"The first, because I came to dishonour my name. So caught up in rage and sorrow was I when you refused me. The second, because she thought as I did, that this meeting was a trap, and I was going to be murdered for what I had done the first time."
"She loves you a great deal, and you her." I could see his reverence for her on his face. And she was right to fear as a mother should for her son. But with the impression you made the first time, there was no cause to have you killed the second. I would defend you, my lord, against any who came to harm you. He shook his head at me.
I still wonder at all this, Matilda,
he admitted, looking about him with disbelieving eyes.
I still do not understand why you would choose me when I behaved so appallingly at our first meeting.
You did, my lord. I do not deny it, nor ever will tell you it was honorable. I smiled. But for me, there can be but one man in the world, and if there is just one man, then he must be the strongest, the boldest, and the most daring of all. Every woman faces risk when she marries, does she not? For she becomes the property of her husband to do with as he wills. But I know your temper now, and I know more than that as well. In that street, there was not one man who dared reach out a hand to stop you, even though I was their lady. They did not have the courage to oppose you. I saw that day the force in your rage, the power of your spirit. There are none who will stand in your way. If I am to marry, then it must be to a man whose spirit matches my own, to one who fears nothing and will take whatever he wants as his own. That is the reason I want to marry you, my lord. You are the man whose soul matches mine. I would take many such beatings, if they were to bring me what I want. William shook his head.
I will never harm you again, he promised. After that first meeting, I was plunged into sorrow and regret, into shame for what I did to you. I swear to you, my lady, I will never harm you again.
That pleases me, I purred. But I would not change the manner of our meeting, for that was what showed me the ruthlessness in you. There could have been no greater sign from God that you were the man for me. I took his hand and kissed it.
You and I together, William, we can take this world and make it ours.
There will be none to stop us or stand against us. All will crumble under the force of our combined wills. I will make all about me, love me, as you will subdue them with fear. Together, we will conquer all. We can have the world, should we wish for it. His eyes flashed with excitement at my words. Here was a man who had had to battle through his life, for his life. But he was also a man who liked to fight.
I pledge you my name, my titles, and all I own, Matilda,
he swore.
And I will protect you and respect your counsel from this day until the end of our days.
And I will give you my hand, dowry, my blood, and my body, William, I replied solemnly. I will give you many fine sons and daughters, and I will offer you my counsel in all that we face together. He kissed my hand again.
Together, he said, there are none who will stand against us.
I smiled wide, deep, and happy. This was the man I had been looking for, and he was mine. Chapter 8 Bruges Castle, Flanders, 1049. Later that night, when the dancing and the feasting was done, when we had eaten of the sweet banquet of fried fruit slices and honey, almond-creamed tart with rose petals, and pears in sugar syrup. When the minstrels had played their last note, and all had escaped to their beds, I sent my maids to the side room of my chamber, under orders of silence, as William snuck into my chambers in the dead of night. His own servants stayed in his chambers at their master's order, and as he came on silent foot up the side passage from the gardens, I opened the door and pulled my future husband into my chambers. "If your father finds me here, he will have my head," William whispered to me, and I laughed quietly at both the unease and excitement in his tone. "We will do nothing unseemly, my lord," my voice purred as I put my hands to his strong chest. "That would be improper before marriage, but I will not have all our wooing done in front of an audience." "This does have some advantages," he agreed, reaching out a hand to my face. His skin was rough, honed under the hilt of a sword blade, and hard with constant practice in battle. I pushed my face into the curve of his hand and kissed the palm where his skin was thick and tough. Then I raised my face to his, and his lips came down on mine. Our lips met in a rush of excitement. I opened my mouth under his and felt his tongue brush mine. His hand stole to my waist as he pulled my body against his, and mine reached up through his hair, pulling him closer to me. There was fire between us, glowing and growing. I had never kissed a man before, but the smooth-shaven skin of William's against mine, the scent of his skin, the softness of his lips, stole my breath. I responded to his lips and his touch, as though I was practiced in the arts of love. As I pulled him closer and molded my body to his, I could feel his excitement increasing. His body hard against mine, we staggered backwards and against a wall. Pressed against that hard surface, with but a painted cloth between me and the wooden wall, I could feel the firm contours of his strong body against the soft curves of mine. His hands remained on my sides, but he clung to me. I could feel an urgency growing in him, but he did not press to take my maidenhood from me. At that time, I would have given it to him, so dazed was I by the power of our embrace. But he did not seek to take it, respecting my person and my titles. The Duke of Normandy came that night to steal but a kiss from the woman he loved. He broke apart from me, and although he did not let me go, he breathed deep. I smiled at him in the light of the candles and the sickle-shaped crest of the moon. My hand reached out again to stroke through his thick, short-cut hair. "There must be some time," I murmured to him, "for you and I to meet without the whole world staring at us and wondering." "I would not disagree with you, my lady," he whispered against my cheek, "for all through that feast I was thinking but of a time when I could have you thus alone." "All that time, my lord?" I teased. "Did you not listen to a word of my conversation?" "With your hand upon my leg," he chuckled, drawing his head back and meeting my eyes. "It was all I could do not to lift you from that table, throw you over my shoulder, and take you to my bed there and then. Your father be damned." I laughed. "And yet now, when you have your chance, you do not press your suit?" William shook his head. "Between us," he lifted a hand from my waist and touched his fingers to my lips, "we must have all things right. You are not a peasant woman, as my mother was, but a woman of title and nobility. If I did not treat you as you deserved when we first met, I will spend the rest of my life honoring you as you deserve." He grinned, his expression wolfish and hungry. "But another kiss will not harm that promise." I sighed as he moved his mouth to mine again, feeling the fluttering excitement of a passion I could only have dreamed of before. Excitement rode through my blood. Our mouths moved together.
his tongue stroking mine until he groaned, released me, and stepped back from me.
"Enough," he said in a gruff voice, "or I will not be able to hold to the promises I have made."
A movement in the outer hall made us start suddenly, and William made a move to the door, his hand on his sword.
"Come back to me tomorrow, my lord,"
I whispered, quickly, as he opened the door to the gardens quietly. His quick grin was dark and handsome in the dim light.
"As my lady commands."
He bowed and kissed me again quickly, before disappearing out of the door. Closing the door and walking through the room, I fell onto my bed, touching my lips where he had kissed me, feeling the heat of his hands where he had touched me. In my body was a feeling I had never experienced before, a restless, surging excitement that sang in my blood, a wanton feeling of desire and of craving for this man I barely knew. Although I hardly knew him, I knew that I loved him, wanted him, desired him. He was merry under his solemnity and playful under his fierceness. He was a warrior, but he was also a fine lord. Oh yes, I knew in so many ways that William, bastard of Normandy, was the only man for me, a cultured barbarian. My barbarian. Through that night, I lay awake long hours, wrestling with the feelings of longing and thirst that I had never had awakened in me before, and counting the days and nights that would have to pass before William could become my husband in truth.
Chapter 9. Lille Castle, Flanders, 1050.
"I do not understand," I hissed, staring at my father with disbelieving eyes. "Why has the Pope condemned the marriage between William and me?"
My father looked at me with sorrow in his face, and with anger, although for once in my life it was not directed at me, but at the missive he held in his hands.
"The Ecclesiastical Council feels that you are too closely related to the Duke."
He threw the parchment to the table before him.
"You are within 7 degrees of kinship to each other."
"Our kinship is no more or less distant than any other noble in Christendom," I disagreed in a sour tone.
"Find me one lord or king who is not in some way related to the wife at his side."
"But we are not direct cousins, not close kin. My mother was married into the House of Normandy, briefly, but she was too young for the match to be consummated, and it was annulled. I do not understand why the Pope would refuse consent for us to marry."
"There is another reason, of course," said my father.
"And one not motivated by any degree of kinship between you." "What, my lord father?"
"We have many enemies surrounding us, daughter. Henry III is the Holy Roman Emperor. He is our enemy, and he leans on the Pope. And there are many lords and potentates who fear the Duke of Normandy."
My father mused, rubbing at an old silver-pink battle scar on his arm, as he thought.
"His recent triumphs and his own ruthlessness have earned the Duke many enemies. Perhaps they have also leaned on the Pope to prevent a marriage that would advance the Duke's power further, and our own."
My father paused and shook his head, exhaling noisily from his nose.
"Edward of England fears Flanders for the refuge we have given to his enemies in the past. It may be that the King of England adds his voice to that of Henry III, fearing that Flanders and Normandy might unite together against him. You make a powerful alliance here, child, a marriage that links you to Normandy and the Duke to both Flanders and the royal seat of the Franks through your mother's blood. Not all lords or kings around us
want to see this event take place?
I nodded.
That would make more sense than this foolishness about our being too closely related.
I looked at my father with a feeling of hopelessness.
What is to be done, father? If we cannot get the approval of the Pope, then can William and I marry at all?
My father shrugged. He was unsure and had no answer for me. I sighed, feeling irritated and annoyed.
Why should Pope Leo IX, the Holy Father, interfere so in the secular matters of the world? If my union with William was, indeed, not being prevented because of an actual spiritual concern, but due to politics, then I was most displeased with the Holy Father. He was not doing his task, appointed by God.
I heard myself cursing at the Pope under my breath. It should have been enough for divine retribution to be exacted on my head. But I believe that God was on my side in this matter. He, too, would have been exasperated in his servant. I was sure. I stood and went to the window, looking out on a misty and grey day in Lille. It was some weeks after the visit made by William and his men to our lands. Many nights of feasting and of kisses and embraces stolen in the dark of night had come to an eventual end as William departed for Reims to find out the decision of the Papal Council on our marriage and to prepare his own court for the coming of its Duchess. But now we heard the Pope's decision. Our marriage was being banned by the leader of the Church. I could hardly believe it. Not to marry William now, after all that we had been through in getting to this point, when I had just found the husband who suited my spirit. It was unthinkable. "I will marry no other man, my Lord Father," I warned, staring out at the villages below. Our castles and territories were much fortified as the conflict with Henry III went on around us. I lived in a world of war, and yet it was my marriage I thought on more than anything.
"Beat me as much as you wish. I fear nothing but being apart from my husband. If I cannot marry William, then I will enter a holy order. Either way, you will not marry me to another."
My father heaved a sigh.
"Matilda," he said gently, "I will not pretend that I understand you. Your mother is a woman of spirit. She convinced me, in my own father's lifetime, to take the seat of power as my own, after all. But even she is not as confusing to me as you are. Perhaps you see strength in the warlike nature of the Duke. You have, after all, been